everyone, and welcome to the Future in Review podcast, where we talk with leaders in tech, investment, and business about the future of technology and the global economy. I'm your host, Barrett Anderson, the COO of Future in Review, which The Economist has called the best technology conference in the world. And I'm here today with Emre Uzat, who is a writer, producer, documentary filmmaker, and director. And he's also the co-founder of Blue Gray Films, which is a production company co-headquartered in Ireland and the US. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
I am. Welcome, Emre.
Nice to see you.
Very glad to have you here with us. So Emre is going to be joining us at Future in Review this year to moderate our Fire Films panel. And he has a really interesting, you have this like fantastic and really interesting background across documentary. So I'm wondering if you can start off by just telling our audience a little bit more about your background and what you've done.
Sure. My original background and training was in theater and music. I was a violinist and a actor and director on stage, started doing international tours, and then got recruited at National Geographic over 20 years ago to work in their story development department. And this is at a time
So you got recruited from theater to National Geographic. How did that happen?
Yeah, it was an entry-level position. I'm not trying to make it sound like I was headhunted, but I was hired in story development as an assistant. And particularly at the time, the trends that people were following were that there was a push for nonfiction television to honor more of story structure. And all of my background and training was on Shakespeare and Beckett and all the rest of it. And how stories are told was always my biggest fascination. So when I joined Nat Geo, my job for many months was both answering phone calls and doing assistancy things, but then primarily at night would be to read the piles and piles of pitches that we brought in and try to generate new projects. So I would do my day job during the day and then write treatments at night. And then some of those started getting picked up and becoming TV shows. So then I started producing them. And that was where I got bitten by that particular bug. And my first shoot was working on a show about animal attacks. And I was based in Australia, carrying a saltwater crocodile on my shoulder and dangling from a helicopter. I was like, this is what the National Geographic experience is supposed to be. Yeah. So I was like, this is pretty cool. This beats standing around waiting for craft services.
Important question. During that process, were you ever yourself attacked by an animal?
Anybody who's worked in our field has had their share of hairy situations. I don't want to overblow them. But certainly had been chased by elephants and handled horrible deadly snakes and all the usual things that one might expect of that sort of situation. But then what was interesting is that over the years, I got to witness a lot of different ships. And at that time, I was working for National Geographic, but on the society side, the Nat Geo Society side, which had this dual thing of being mission-driven programming, but also having to feed the cable television industry. So balancing those two sides of the purpose-driven storytelling and how to actually maximize audience reach was always part of the dynamic. And so back in those days, there was a lot of conversation about, should there be reenactments and could it be more like CSI? Could things be more like those sort of franchise cable things that people think of? And then over the years, from there, I ended up going on to Europe and working for Off the Fence, which is an international distributor and production company. I worked on a lot of co-productions and worked on a lot of seeing what it was like for Arte in France and for ZDF in Germany. What's it like for NHK in Japan and these other sort of conglomerates like Sky and all these sort of other players in the industry. Got to have that experience for a good few years. And then finally got brought over to Netflix to work on the documentary series team there as a commissioner and the EP, the creative executive, for a few years, and then now back to filmmaking in the last year or so.
So if you've worked with so many different production companies and in so many different spaces, I'm curious, if you were to start your own, I mean, you have your own production company now, but if you were to run your own kind of network that was focused on documentary, what would you be looking for now, just based on your own personal instincts, and why?
I think that's an excellent question. I think that's one that a lot of producers in general would do well to put themselves in the shoes of. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest things I learned in my years in Europe was that the
all the broadcasters and the channels and the distributors, everybody has their own particular needs and their anxieties, and everybody's worried about their own jobs and their slates. And as a filmmaker, I found it really focusing and valuable to try to put myself in the situation of all those people and to think, all right, if I'm going to develop this thing, am I developing the story because I'm personally interested in it, or am I developing it because I think there is a sizable audience there? Am I doing it because there's impact purpose? And we started making films that were much more trying to hit holistically. So we would do like a film about elephants, but then we would also do an entire educational shorts platform viewing experience that we would do in partnership with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, for example, or that we'd make gamified pieces, or we would make campaign social media pieces and then make an immersive dome experience. And so that experience, I think, definitely started to make, put you in a position of thinking of yourself as all of the, a cipher for all the proxy for all the stakeholders who are trying to think about their issue or their concerns. And as a storyteller, being able to craft the story to fit each of those places gave some flexibility.
So thinking more across multi-platform is what I'm hearing. Is that fair?
Well, that's one of the things. I mean, for something, for that particular, you know, for the elephant films that we made, I ended up making 5 elephant films and a bunch of shorts and stuff like that. But it was all around these ideas of trying to A, track how many elephants are left, B, try to affect the ivory trade, C, try to understand more about elephant behavior and culture and anatomy and all the rest of that. And it was like, much the desires were more than just, I want to make a film that shows at festivals and wins awards. The desire was to spread overall understanding of an issue.
Right. It was
so
behavior
we targeted
change.
The story that way. Yeah.
Yeah.
But then other times we make shows that are very much geared towards the audience first. And for platforms, whether they're Netflix or Apple or Amazon or Disney or anybody, you know, what they're trying to do is wisely invest their subscribers' money to maximize value for those subscribers. And, you know, to me, that is a much less cynical way of looking at the sort of commercial side of documentary making than I think the narrative that gets spun a bit.
Okay, let's talk about that a little bit more, because I think there are a lot of people, I'm sure, out there who are very curious about how Netflix makes decisions. You're saying that approach is really about, are they breaking down their audience and saying, we have this many people that we know are interested in this, and therefore we're trying to invest our money based on our audience metrics? Is that?
I mean, I would say every network is doing some version of that.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's trying to figure out whether they have a very specific demographic they're trying to hit. At Netflix, we didn't think too much in terms of individual demographics. I don't think I'm speaking out of school to say that Netflix operates more on taste clusters. If you like this, you might like that. If you're the type of person who likes this sort of thing, you might be the type of person who likes that sort of thing. And that approach to commissioning and filmmaking actually, for me, was a bit freeing, because you could say, look, I'm more going for a mood. I'm more going for a need state. I'm more going for a sense of connection to an individual person, or a sense of wanting to escape into a new world or explore a different place. You could balance the needs of entertainment and information and target it for whatever need state you were trying to develop it for. We did a good bit of internal development on some projects while I was there, and I think it wore out pretty well.
So you were there for how long?
Just under 3 years.
3 years. Okay.
Yep.
And I'm curious.
And I worked on about 25 series during that
okay.
time.
Yeah. Yeah. So you were busy. You weren't sitting around, twiddling your thumb.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, like, how did you see the documentary film world change over that time as far as what people were producing, or were there changes in the content, types of content, or the types of pitches you were getting? And
yeah.
What was influencing this?
I think there's a few drivers there. Having done this for 20 years now, like I feel like those shifts come in some kinds of waves, and they have peaks and flows. There are always periods of time where everybody's chasing a certain kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of what I've witnessed in the last few years, in terms of the documentary landscape, I feel like there was a period of perhaps overextension, maybe a little bit too much hyping on the behalf of the industry as a whole. I'm not saying particular buying group or Netflix or Disney or something. I just mean it, and on the whole, there might have been a bit of an over commitment and a little bit of over bullishness on let's pre-finance films fully, take them to festivals, and then assume that they're going to get picked up for a lot of money. That does work a few times, but overall, that the as the competition intensifies between the major players in the marketplace, those players are increasingly have to protect their corner,
their little zone.
So they're either would sign multi-film deals with some filmmakers, or they would focus more on internal development using their own data of what they think is going to be good. And those slots start filling up. And then once those businesses need to shrink or expand those slots, then the things that are available might not line up with the timing of what's being released. And of course, COVID threw all of that into a big spiral as well, where film festivals weren't happening. So the sort of that mode of buyers all having to show up at a festival to watch a film and compete against each other or feel that energy and the buzz of the audience wasn't happening. And so a good few films were held back. And this sort of made a timing of the glut of release of some films hitting the marketplace be too many at once. So a lot of people lately have been talking about there being a shrink in the
number
of films that are being picked up. But I think that's a little bit, I think we have to be a little careful of how we look at that data at the moment. Looking at analytically, say it just might be that the timing of it is hit a spot where the business model itself is shifting and we're coming out of COVID and there's a lot of different factors happening at the same time. And some of the Warner Discovery, that whole merger happening and shifting and some channels being eliminated entirely. There's that when the broadcasting landscape shifts in that way, adjustments are going to have to be made. And often what happens there is some films end up losing some money. That's the nature of the business.
So let me tell you what I feel like I saw happening over, and I want to hear if you think this is true. So there was, and this is not just for documentary film either. This is true across series, long form narrative films, and also documentary, but there was this massive rush by all the big platforms who were competing to be like, to create these kind of like blockbuster, big high dollar productions, whether they were whatever format they were. And then all of a sudden it's like they hit their max and they realized that they couldn't get as much of a return on what they thought they could as they, and then they're like, oh, we overspent. And then at the same time, there was a lot of kind of mergers and so a little bit of a kind of a conglomeration of the industry, fewer buyers. Nat Geo was purchased by the Murdochs. So that was an interesting moment for documentary as well. And now we're in this space where artificial intelligence is coming in. We've got all these, there's a writer strike, there's an actor strike. Documentary isn't in that space, but I would assume that's probably affecting it in some way as well. And I'm curious if you can talk more about like, where do we go? Does that seem like a correct trajectory? And what comes next?
Fantastic question. I think in some ways the documentary industry has to sit a little bit parallel to what's been going on with the writers and actors strikes. There's some overlap for sure. You might have some star writers or star directors or actors who might not want to take a project to market, but we've got to keep in mind that most of the documentary industry is not union.
Right.
It's kept that way. What's that?
It's hard. It is written. Yeah. Some documentaries are scripted, but it's also much less written than the average.
Oh, yeah. It's less written in the sort of narrative film sense. Yeah. But yeah, it's just it being that sort of non-union, it often is very bootstraps. There are filmmakers who, like Kudi and Chike, who spent 20 years following Kanye. That's just their life. I spoke to a filmmaker the other day who had been working. He said, I want to show you my updated footage on my new nature film. And I said, isn't that the one we talked about 5 years ago, 6 years ago? He said, yeah, I was working on it for 5 years then. Now it's been 10 years. Like now it's almost ready. That's not that uncommon, especially in some of the subgenres like nature, is that there's so much passion and dedication and people who are willing to do this work for free because they have to. A lot of filmmakers are driven by that innate desire to tell that story, that the ups and downs of the buying marketplace in some ways are, I know they're super relevant for production companies, but in some ways for documentary filmmakers, it's a little less relevant. It can be a little less relevant because you're focusing on a story that's on a different kind of time trajectory. The other thing I wanted to say about that is in terms of where I think the opportunity is for it to go is that in these moments of upturns and downturns in the overall marketplace, it's proven over and over again that nonfiction yields great returns for broadcasters and platforms. And in terms of viewing impact, you look at any week's top 10 list on Netflix and on series, you're seeing shows that are going toe to toe with really, really expensive dramas, and they're costing a fraction of the cost and they're having great big impact. More and more people are watching documentaries than ever. The audience size is there. The audience is absolutely out there. And they're hungry for this content. But I think it's where I personally see, in terms of when I was thinking of this conversation in the context of this conference of people who are thinking ahead and looking towards the next step of the trend, I think just like in any other business, it's very dangerous to just look at what's happening right now and try to react to it when all of the buyers and commissioners and distributors, they're always thinking on a 3-year, 4-year window. When I left Netflix, there were shows on my slate that aren't coming out till 2024, 2025, my other series in 2026. So the way that the commissioners are thinking is not what's going to be a hit right now. It's what's going to be a hit 2 years from now, 2.5 years from now, 3 years from now. Where do we think the audiences are going to be? And so I think in terms of financing of films, I think that there is a potential to think for financiers and grant givers and donors, private donors and investors, to think more like broadcasters in a way. And what we say is think slate, not slots. So one of the things that I would say is I'd love to do a little thought experiment is
when you say slate, not slots, if we're translating that, that would mean think about the portfolio as opposed to just putting things in and making it work as a whole, as opposed to just a bunch of one-offs.
Yeah. So if I were to say to you, Barrett, like you are a commissioner of a documentary slot and on a platform, let's say I'm going to give you a budget. I say to you, you have $1.5 million. You get to spend it on one documentary. And if that documentary is successful and lots of people watch it, you get to keep your job. Mm-hmm. And if it is not successful, you're fired.
This would be a fun board game, actually.
Yeah, but think about how you might make that choice, how you might make that decision of what you're going to invest that money in. But if I said to you instead, Barrett, what you have is $1.5 million to put towards a slate of 10 projects, you might think about it that very differently. You might think about it in terms of, oh, actually, I could probably invest in $200,000 development deals. I could do a co-production with a German broadcaster and maximize this piece. I could go and find something that's really targeted to an audience there. And so that on an individual film basis, no studio lives on a film by film basis. Yes, your success is made up of individual good choices, but it's always a portfolio. You're always thinking of things as a portfolio, just like any investor. Mm-hmm. And I feel like too many times we've put donors and investors, and especially the early stages of a documentary, which are so important, we put them in the position of that you have $1.5 million to spend on one film and you have to go all in, or you have to get your friends to come in and everybody's going to spend all this money. And then we're going to take it to a festival, and then it's going to get awards at that festival. And then it's going to get Hollywood Reporter's going to talk about it. And then there's going to be a bidding war. It's imagining that there's going to be this magical moment 2.5, 3 years from now, when all these festivals are happening and that buying marketplace of that is going to be perfect for then. So I think that if we can find a way for people who are interested in causes that they care about or the kind of stories that they care about to pool resources or to think in terms of developing multiple projects within the same space. If I care about, let's say pick a topic. If I care about AI and I want to get a particular message out about AI, one way is I could do is I could go and find best filmmaker I can think of out there. I can go and get a great director to go and develop me a film. I can invest in that person and go down that route. Or what I could do is maybe partner up with Vox to do an informational type of series around that topic, develop that, give them
more,
some money to get
more
somebody.
More of a cultural narrative shift is what you're saying than just or blockbuster.
Yeah. I think also in terms of like for impact filmmaking, it's thinking of it in terms of that there are multiple ways that a story can live. And maybe one of them will get traction with a buyer from the ground up, and another one will get traction as a co-production, or as it might get more donor finance funding. One might be more, you know, targeted towards a very small audience who's going to have that impact POV. It just feels like at the moment, a lot of independent filmmakers, having witnessed the tightening of the market, are witnessing donors and funders also contracting instead of pivoting, instead of saying, all right, actually, we do want to get these stories out there. There need to be things that people invest in that are not just true crime stories. Somebody needs to invest in those great investigative documentaries, those great, really special stories. That investment's more important now than ever, but it's encouraging those like-minded individuals to come up with different ways of approaching that funding.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm curious, you mentioned thinking about what the audience will want 3 to 4 years from now. What do you, like in the Book of Emre, what is that?
Well, yes, I know everything that the audience will want.
Question, right? Because it's always interesting to hear someone else's perspective about what do you think people are going to want in 3 to 4 years?
I only know how I go about development, which is intuitive and scattershot and all over the place. I tend to go for a really wide diversity of ideas at the same time. It just has always been my way. Like I came up through that Nat Geo system of there was so many shows that need to be developed. So I tend to have something that really feels like a passion project that I personally really want to direct, or one that I can exec produce, and some that I can hedge a different way. But the common denominator, what I look for in projects, is always something that scares me. So to me, that thing can either feel really creatively dangerous, or it can feel personally dangerous, or it can feel like the information itself is titillating or dangerous. There's something that is, if I don't get the sensation that I might never be allowed to make another film again, if I screw this up, then I'm usually not that keen. That's
a good one. There's this common, I don't know if it's common or not, but there's a saying that I like to bring to my work and how I think about things, which is courage is not the absence of fear, right? Courage is experiencing the fear and doing the thing anyways. Everyone has fear. And it's not like some people just don't have it. We all have it. And so those people that are willing to take risks and are willing to do things that scare them, I feel are rare in the world. And really, well, the cause often of a lot of really incredible works of art or great pieces of journalism or great, really incredible businesses, whatever it might be, it always is about overcoming that fear and doing something scary. So I just really love that narrative.
Yeah, for sure. And sometimes that shows up, like when I was at Netflix, I commissioned a docudrama, and I'd never done that before. And it was really big and expensive and really scary, but I'm very excited about it. And it's not announced yet, I don't think. So I won't say anything more about it. But But then is taking that fear moment and say, oh, wouldn't it be great if we could do this? Sarah Edelson, who I used to report to at Netflix, she and I talked a lot, and out of some of our conversations, the Unknown series came about, which was looking at if we could take these sort of specialist factual science and exploration kind of shows, and what would happen if we just went all in and trying to execute them as be there in the moment where the discovery is occurring and really trying to hone on that kind of thing, and what kind of investment would it take? Or when we did the Inspiration 4 mission to space, I tried to do a live space shuttle launch and fast follow episodes and treat space science like it's a live sporting event almost, and just start taking kind of risks. And sometimes they work really well and sometimes they don't, but you start with that fear moment and go, what's that thing that I don't think I could actually do? It seems like I will go for this and people are going to laugh at me, but if it's executed well enough, and then you try to solve for, all right, now let's try to, what would take away that fear? Oh, I wouldn't be so scared if we had Steven Spielberg execing
right. life on our planet. Sure, and there he comes in. It's not my show, but it's an example.
Yeah.
Or it's, so then it's like taking the, then mitigating each of those risk factors so you can try to make the best story you can. That's just how my brain seems to come at these things. But it always takes, and it always, for me, I've always, have you ever seen that movie Heist with it's a David Mamet film?
No.
And Gene Hackman says, they say to him, how do you come up with your amazing heist? And he says, I always try to think of someone smarter than myself. And I ask, what would he do? And there's a point in every single project that I've ever been involved with that I thought, gosh, this is above my pay grade. I wish there was somebody smarter. Guess what? That's going to be the director that I work with. That's going to be the exec producer.
Finding the people who can bring that, that level of. So we just have a couple of minutes left, and I want to make sure we get to two last questions. One of which is, you are now working on a film yourself. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I can speak in slightly more general terms because obviously nobody ever wants to get scooped on something that
I'm assuming this is something that scared you. We can start there.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, there's always something scary about each of these projects. Yeah, there's a number of projects that we have in development at Blue Gray Films, but my partner, Kate Bradbury, and I, one of the sort of business level things that we think is like way overdue in our industry is, for us, trying to make that choice between scaling and partnering. And so we partnered with Consequential Films, Ruth Johnson and Ted Rashane, who were formerly of Vulcan, Paul Allen's company. And so Ruth is a phenomenal producer, worked on Reason I Jump and Summer of Soul and all these wonderful projects. And Ted Rashane, who used to head up Impact at Vulcan, really smart, switched on guy. So we are working together on two feature docs that we're developing at the same time. And that's to try to share our resources and points of view. One is in the sports and health and wellness space. And looking at a particular kind of gap in medicine that we feel like affects everybody. And the other one is one that's in the sort of music and health and wellness space. So both of them have a bit of science, a bit of feel good, a bit of something that touches everybody. And we're trying to, in both these films, balance some of the message that we really want to spread out there, but that are grounded in reality, but able to be fantastical and able to take us to places that we've never been. Really, both of these films that we're developing at the moment are very much, I'd say, aspirational, feel great pieces that will also get us a little angry and make us want to change things a little bit at the same time. So they're definitely a high wire. We should talk more detail about them in person.
We'll come back to you when you're further along. Sure. Okay, so final question. If you were to give, if you had a documentary filmmaker sitting in front of you right now, and I'm sure there are many documentary filmmakers out there who would love to talk to you about this, but what advice would you give them about developing a new project or selecting a new project?
My advice to documentary, any kind of filmmaker, any type of storyteller, I don't know the answer. This is just my thing. But my preference is to not treat creativity as a mercenary action. So what I mean by that is to, instead of thinking about, let me look at the mandates, what are the buyers saying that they want right now? And let me develop towards that. And I'll just do the thing that I think that the client wants. I would say, treat yourself like the adult and the expert that you are.
Right.
Find the story that really moves you. And then try to find which audience that might work for the best. Is it an audience, as in a part of the general public, or is it the audience? And if what you're looking for in your story, what really resonates, is something that speaks to an audience, this one's for 18 to 34 women.
Right.
This is really specific for that sort of thing, or people who love Beyonce are going to watch this film, then target it accordingly. Beyonce is not niche at all. That's a terrible example. It's for everybody.
Beyonce is the audience.
Beyonce is the audience. But if you develop the thing that you are most passionate about, that you think is not only the story that you want to tell, but if you put yourself in a buyer's perspective that you think will actually work well for a lot of people, then you can find the market for that film. It's
I think it's very dangerous and very counterproductive. And I don't think it increases the success rate overall, in my experience, to say, oh, let me chase after what I think the networks might want.
Yeah.
Well, that intel is useless.
The other side of that coin, though, I think it's great advice. And the other side of that coin is that as a creator, you and I both know, being independent creators of different kinds, when you really care about something, that's when you make it great, right? It's hard. It's so much harder to make something amazing about something that you're not that passionate about. So
yeah, I read James Clear has this great thing that he says when you're starting any project, he says, you got to begin optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
If you start off pessimistic, you're never going to make anything in the first place. So you got to really love it in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to believe that thing that you want to do is possible to do. Then after you've started, now you got to get real pessimistic. You got to hate every piece of it. You got to try to find the stress points and make it as good as you possibly can. But then as you get closer to the finish line, you have to turn optimistic again. If you stay in a looking for faults modality when you're in those final stages, it's very easy to get very frustrated. You need that last dose of optimism to get you over the line. At some point, film has got to get out. Even Martin Scorsese probably doesn't love every shot of every film he's ever released in the world. So that's life. The film is not going to be perfect. You got to be able to end it.
Perfect enemy good, as they say.
Yeah, so my insights are probably wonderful, intelligent people that come on this podcast. But
no, it's definitely true. I think that trajectory is interesting as well. The transition between the perfectionist and the good enough, and when to move through those different approaches is something that takes time to learn. I've watched a lot of really incredible and talented filmmakers also struggle with letting go at the end. I think that's one of the things that's particularly hard for people who care deeply about their projects.
And it's very hard to know the difference between, could we get this show, this film, this series, could we get it 5% better? Could we get it 10% better? At that part where you're very tired and you're running low on your budget and you don't really want to ask your partner for extra money. If you don't want to ask for that extra $30,000 for a reshoot, you don't want to ask for that changing that composer or whatever that thing is. But that building the intuition about that phase of when to switch and say, all right, this is actually knowing when you're there is it's a hard thing. And I've seen very experienced people falter it. I falter at it all the time. It's a tough call to make.
Emery, I'm very excited that you will be joining us in LA this fall. We have a slate of really incredible filmmakers who will be a part of that conversation. I'm so excited to hang out with all of you in person.
Can we say their names now?
Yes.
Announce it?
Well, I think we can say some of their names. You can say Joe's name. Joe.
Okay.
Joe Piscatella.
Wonderful Joe Piscatella. Can we say, you have to tell me which ones we can say. Then. I don't know.
Joe made an incredible film called Who is Afraid of Nathan Law? And that is not going to be released because its subject is under threat by the Chinese Communist Party and their families. And we're going to have him on to talk about that a little bit. And then you want to say there's a film called, let's save the rest of them because we're still figuring out exactly what the formulation is. And I don't want to say anything, but it will be a great slot of films, a lot of people.
Having seen this the lineup, I'm very excited. These are the filmmakers that have been at different phases in their career, but have all affecting making really incredible films. So I really can't wait to speak to all of them and to speak to you. And the last time I was at Fire in San Diego, it was so wonderful. I really loved listening in on all the conversations. So I'm really looking forward to that. Thank you so much for putting it together and for having me on.
Absolutely. And thanks for talking to me today about filmmaking. It's been fantastic.
All right. Thanks.